Okay, just for the folks on the phone, we're going to go around one time real quick and just do introductions, and we'll make Daniel start, if you don't mind.
Dan Kivlahan, Department of Veterans Affairs.
Rhonda Robinson-Beal, Optimus.
Tom James, and I'm still Tom James, Humana.
Laura Lennon-Bach with LA Care.
Heidi Bosley, NQF. Sarah Lash, NQF.
Alice Lind, Center for Healthcare Strategies.
Connie Huang, NQF.
Diane Stollenwerk, NQF.
Rita Vandervoort, SAMHSA.
Jim Dunford, City of San Diego, representing Emergency Medical Services.
Steve Council from Indianapolis, representing the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems.
Leonardo Payo, National Health Law Program.
Jenny Kuhn Hansen, the American Geriatric Society.
Adam Burrows, National PACE Association.
Thank you. Are there folks on the committee on the phone right now? Okie doke. What I'm going to do first is just a quick recap for those of you who were here yesterday. These are just the same points that Diane covered at the end of the day, but we have a couple new people, so we'll just run through them very quickly. The themes from yesterday, number one, we brought up some new or renewed themes around what we are hoping that the measures will touch on, including connectedness, person-centeredness, aligning shared accountability across entities, including providers, payers, et cetera, and the high-priority areas for the duals. And, again, staying focused on the things that we've already identified and fleshing those out to the extent possible. We've talked some about the state's role and engagement with the help of our colleagues from New York yesterday, and that was a very useful conversation. They frame the way that they think about the population a little bit differently than we perhaps have been thinking about it, so that was a help. Some of the ideas that came out of that conversation were about data barriers and standardized measures versus the ability to benchmark across states versus the state's development of their own good measures, which they then may or may not submit for standardization nationally. Other themes that we touched on were going back to the core measure set and looking to see if there are things that we could do to flesh those out. We'll have more discussion on that and activity surrounding that today. Some of the more general challenges that we touched on yesterday were how to balance the need to have a nice short list of high-priority measures versus getting the best or the right measures more fleshed out and having a longer set. We also talked about the helpfulness of composite measures or measures that cross multiple settings. And then finally, just thinking again about the person-centeredness approach to quality measurement to make sure that we have the goals of the patient in mind and beyond the person's role as a patient, how do they experience their quality of life. There's some examples on this slide of different considerations for many of the measures that we talked about, including multiple versions of CAHPS and whether we should recommend that CAHPS surveys are used across whatever settings they're available for. We talked about pain management and the measures that are available to track that. We talked about medication management, which goes beyond just the concrete measures that we have in our hands now to the concepts of appropriateness of prescription. Readmits, we had a long conversation about the challenges of the readmit measure, and at some appropriate break, you could also pick Sarah Scholey's brain about that today, but not right this minute. And then we talked about unintended consequences of the measures that we choose. We talks about alignment with Medicaid adult core set. That was it was helpful to have Karen Yanos here from CMS yesterday to talk about the work that they had done. And this brought up the whole challenge of syncing our measures to other core sets, and Cheryl Powell actually gave a helpful direction here that syncing isn't quite so important. Making sure that the measure sets are complementary also is a good consideration. We had a good presentation on stratification, which again left, came back around to Cheryl making the observation that from her standpoint, having measures specificity for duals is her, that's her challenge in life. And so whether people are in demos or not in demos, from Cheryl's perspective, that we do need to track the quality of care for the dual population over time. And so it's not so important that the measures work to stratify duals against Medicare or duals against Medicaid or duals against the commercial population. What she wants to know is, are they doing things in the duals office to observe changes in quality of care from year to year? And so so for her standpoint, stratification is important in and of itself. So I thought that was very helpful to come back around to at the end of that conversation. I think these are the final, this is the final group, is on the home and community-based services list. Again, Anita Yaskalskis was here yesterday from CMS and sharing with us some of the work that they're doing to try to come to standardization. They have a couple of different measures or measure sets that they'll be trying to test over the next year or two. So there's hope in the future of having some standardization of the home and community-based measures, which right now are not standard across states at all. So that's a glimmer of hope for us. Today's agenda, again, as promised, we have just a couple of presentations this morning, and then a lot of our work is going to be in working sessions. We're going to prioritize the gap areas, prioritize the measures or the measure concepts, and then spend the afternoon talking about what we need to see in the final report to HHS. So, knowing that some of you probably have planes to catch tonight, we are going to be crisply walking through the agenda. And if we get to any little places of stuckness, there's always things that we can do after the meeting is concluded to make sure that we've gathered up all of your good thinking following the meeting. So hopefully you won't feel like any important discussion is being left out, and we'll have a chance to circle back to it. Any questions about that? Any questions about the task today or conversation from yesterday? Brilliant ideas that came up for you 2 in the morning? No? Oh, Sarah points out that if you have written comments on any of the measures or gaps that you came up with last night in your homework assignment, that you could give them to Amaru over there, and he will help make sure that they get into the record. Deb. So Sarah's going to send out an electronic version of the measure sets and the gaps to everybody, so we'll be able to comment on those electronic copies. Anything else before we get going? All righty. So first up, we have Sarah Scholey from NCQA and Karen Sapuka, is that how you pronounce it, on the phone with us too, and Heidi Bosley, who's here in the room with us. And I'm going to pass the controls here to Sarah, and thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Everyone, I think I've met many of you. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak this morning. And so what I wanted to do, or what I was asked to do, is to talk a little bit about the measure development process, and I wanted to put it into the context of work that we're currently
that we currently have underway. It's supported by the SCAN Foundation, where we're actually struggling with the challenge of trying to develop measures for people who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. And so in this presentation, I'd like to talk a little bit about the efforts that we've, what we've done so far and what we're planning to do, and then try to give you some feel for what that process of measure development is like, and show you some examples from previous work. So in this project that we have that's focusing on people with dual eligibility, we actually completed some work last year where we did an environmental scan of existing programs, efforts, measures that look at care for this population. We also held several discussions with stakeholders to try to understand what are the key concerns of, in particular, of consumer groups. And of course, it's challenging with this population of dual eligibility because it's not exactly one population, but many diverse groups. And then based on that, we drafted a framework for helping us to think about the expectations of care. And then in the work that we're doing right now, we'll be working with states and with model programs to develop a draft set of measures, and it's our desire to test those measures in organizations with different service delivery models. So the domains that we've identified sound a lot like what I saw as I was reading through the materials that you've developed. And so let me just say a little bit about how we're thinking about this. So what we're thinking about are structure and process measures that will help us to understand whether an organization that takes responsibility for the care of people with dual eligibility across all kinds of settings of care, so including long-term services and supports, home and community-based services, nursing homes, healthcare, you know, in primary care and hospital. So that kind of entity that's responsible for all of that kind of care doesn't really exist yet, or it's starting to exist in some states under some of the demos, but the existing measures don't really work because they're pretty much created for the organizations that have accountability today. So we have measures for primary care providers, we have measures for health plans, we have measures for nursing homes, but we don't have something that looks across that span of services, and so that's what we're interested in looking at. But in some ways, we have to imagine what will be that accountable entity, and how will that accountable entity have access to information that would allow it to determine whether a comprehensive needs assessment has occurred, whether that needs assessment gets pulled into a shared care plan, and to evaluate whether delivery care is being delivered in accordance with that care plan, and that the whole thing is getting updated over time. And so in our view of this, we really see that, you know, on the left side of this slide, you see those three pieces: needs assessment, care plan, care delivery. And then those feed into our goals, which are healthy people, so that are healthy communities. That gets at those measures that look at experiences of care, quality of life, choice of care, and choice of setting of care, continuity for individuals. So we're interested in thinking about what would those outcomes look like. I see that's on your list of gap areas. We're interested in using existing measures that might be able to help us track the affordability or cost of care. And so I know you've talked about readmissions apparently, but also there other ways to try to combine the data so that we know how much money is actually being spent on care. And then you can measure better care with some of the existing measures that look at quality, effectiveness of treatment for specific conditions. But I think what's new about this framework is that we're actually saying, you know, it has to exist on a platform of electronic data sharing and a system for quality improvement. And part of the role of that system for quality improvement and that data system is to produce the data that would allow us to track
quality, you know, as we've defined it in these two columns here. Because today, we don't really have the systems in place to know whether the care plan's been identified, so you know, and whether that's available to all the people provided. We also don't have the systems in place to really track those issues around experiences of care and quality of life. We don't even know how we're going to find those, find the right people to ask the right questions, using what sort of data collection mode, et cetera. So those are the kinds of issues we're trying to think about. And it may be that our first steps need to focus on articulating the structures and processes, including the quality improvement systems and the data systems, that infrastructure that needs to be in place for a learning organization to be an organization that's really observing quality and observing patient preferences and trying to help patients and families and get what they need. Okay, so that's our vision. Now, what's the process that we're going to use to actually get to some measures? And I wanted to just briefly describe our approach to measure development and let you understand where we are in that process. So the first step is really trying to identify measure concepts. So what should we be measuring? What are the important topics? And as we've mentioned, some of the work that we've done has been to do an environmental scan. We're certainly going to be looking at your gap analysis to see how that could inform the work that we're doing. And then to begin to identify preliminary measure concepts. So we convened a stakeholder group to give us an idea of where we should focus our effort. And our thinking is that we really should be focusing on that information that can only come from consumers and their families about their experiences and their opportunities for choice, their preference, whether preferences are met, how the care affects their quality of life. We'd like to really focus on that as we think about our measures. We'll draft specifications, and then we go into a testing process that will involve field testing, getting testing in specific sites so that we have quantitative data, but also feasibility testing where we might go to specific kinds of stakeholders to say, could you actually implement these and how would you do it? And then also, as you can see, this is adapted from a project that I'm going to talk about in just a minute, where we'll actually summarize findings and finalize specifications. So as we go through this work, I mean, we've already identified a number of issues that are going to be a challenge for us because our goal is to develop measures that would be suitable for consideration for endorsement by the National Quality Forum. So we're thinking importance, right? We get the importance by talking with stakeholders, finding out what's important to consumers. Evidence-based. That gets to be a really huge challenge here because things like you want care to be coordinated, you want preferences to be elicited and met to the extent that it's possible and reasonable and makes sense for this particular person. Those kinds of topics, the evidence that a specific activity actually leads to improvements in outcomes or reductions in cost or some sort of benefit is actually challenging. And so we're going to be, that's one of the challenges that we're going to face is trying to articulate why we think a measure is critical here. Small numbers are a big issue that we've seen certainly in the work that we've done with measures. I was just reviewing data on our behavioral health measures that are in HEDIS, and we have a number of health plans that aren't really able to report those measures because of the narrowness of the denominators, right? The evidence base is very for a very specific group of people, so the measures get to be applied to a very specific denominator, and then that means you have small numbers, especially in organizations that are serving consumers with lots of different kinds of needs. So that's going to be a challenge. I mentioned availability of data and the workflow that's going to support tracking of information. So one of the things that I've been working on is a version of the CAHPS survey for patient-centered medical homes. And how do we, where would that data be collected? Who should do the surveys? We have a lot of evidence that the surveys that are collected on site in a doctor's office are subject to bias, and so for reporting of this survey to NCQA under one of our programs for medical homes now, we don't accept on-site surveys. Well, that's a real challenge for some organizations. And so we're really trying to think through those data and workflow issues and what would be, especially for a population that might be served in home and community-based services or nursing homes, what's the reality of how we could collect the data? So we're going to be thinking through what's not just the availability of current data, what would the workflow need to be in order to track those things? I already mentioned who's accountable and who's accountable across, if we're really thinking about an entire person and across all the things they deal with. How do we, so patient and family-centered approach is certainly at the forefront of our thinking. That actually can be a challenge if a consumer doesn't have a family or doesn't or has different desires in the family. How do we manage those kinds of issues? And then I know Karen might be talking about these issues, but because we're very interested in getting information from consumers and families, we're really concerned about issues around cognition and literacy. When do we use proxies? So these are the kinds of technical issues before we can get to a measure that could be implemented. We have to try to identify how this would work. And that's part of what we're going to struggle with. So that's kind of where we're headed with our work on duals, and certainly we're going to be reading your report very carefully. But I wanted to give you an idea of what this plays out, how this plays out in the real world from a project we recently completed. It was funded by ASPE, and we were asked to develop measures to assess the quality of care provided to Medicaid beneficiaries with schizophrenia. And we were given some guidance that was very helpful. We were told focus on ambulatory care, focus on evidence-based practices because we want these measures to be NQF endorsed. Address the following domains. So pharmacotherapy, psychosocial care, and physical health. So it was really important to our charge was to say, don't just go to drugs. We know there's evidence based around drugs. Go look at the other kinds of care for people with schizophrenia. So we really liked this charge because it was broad, but actually it was also very narrow because they said use claims data only and focus on evidence-based practices. So that was our challenge. And if you look at this, I wanted to kind of cut to the chase and show you what we ended up doing. So we did focus groups. So we did field testing and claims data. We talked to a bunch of states and behavioral health managed care organizations. And so you can see that we actually identified a number of measure concepts that we considered, some addressing pharmacotherapy like continuity of antipsychotics or polypharmacy, psychosocial needs, including the evidence-based treatments that are part of, that were demonstrated through the PORT research, physical health needs, so a lot of interest in trying to think about the physical health needs of the schizophrenia population, some cross-cutting issues that relate to physical health, side effects of medications, et cetera, and then some other kinds of access issues. So if you look on under the specified measures on all of these, we are submitting for NQF endorsement, and most of them are being considered or out for public comment right now for HEDIS for Medicaid health plans. So we ended up dropping a bunch of really good ideas that I see are on your list, and I just want to explain a little bit about why. And polypharmacy, a lot of concern about the evidence base for when is polypharmacy really a bad thing. Okay, so that one was evidence-based. Clozapine for treatment-resistant patients. How do you find the denominator? Psychosocial needs. What we found was we were restricted to claims data, And so we found claims for many of these psychosocial treatments, or we found that some states were using codes for these, and you could find it. But when we talked with folks from states, they said, oh, yeah, but you know what? It really would not, I really don't want to be judged on that, because what we do is really different from what the evidence base is. And we didn't have a lot of confidence that the codes were consistent with the evidence base, or that we would be able to really say something fair about what was happening in one state versus another state, because the codes, you know, in one state, ACT might be like one visit, or, you know, just not the same level of, there's not a measure of fidelity to that actual evidence-based practice. So that's a huge issue for psychosocial treatment generally. We had a lot of interest in a measure about smoking cessation counseling, and there is a code for that in the claims, but it was not used. And besides, we wouldn't be able to identify who was a smoker anyway from claims. So that's why I see you've got the CAPS smoking cessation measure is in the adult core set for Medicaid, but it's still a challenge because that means you're only looking at the people who fill out that survey. So anyway, you can get a sense of why, you know, I wanted you to have a sense that even though you think about a whole range of measures, what you come out at the end, it's always smaller than what you start with. And some of the issues relate to really having a strong evidence base where you can say, we really have specified that by having this measure, we know there's going to be some attention given to making sure that people in that denominator get the service in the numerator. And if we're going to do that, we will want to be pretty confident that we're not encouraging care for where it's not warranted or not appropriate. We're strong concerns about whether or not we can, you know, we're going to making apples-to-apples comparisons across the different organizations or settings that we're comparing. And then challenges, you know, in this particular case, it was really about claims data. What we could do from the measure that we developed needs to match both the level of accountability, right? So is it the state? Is it the provider? Is it some organization that's taking responsibility for people with dual eligibility across all their settings? It has to match accountability and the data sources available. And so when you have claims data that, you know, states have claims data, they can look at these kinds of services. But when we want to try to get into the clinical content of care that's not in claims, then we have to think about, well, how do we get to that and how much of a burden is it for feasibility? And sometimes, you know, we actually, as a group, we thought, you know, there may need to be some more structure and process kinds of measures that encourage people to develop, to implement evidence-based practices so that, you know, before we start to have a measure that says, did you get supported employment, we actually have a measure that says, this is an organization that is probably doing supported employment. It's something that's close to the evidence-based model. And so it might need to be paired that way. So those are the kinds of things that we're going to be keeping in mind as we move forward with our work.
Wow. Very useful and grounding. So in this brief section, we have three presentations, so we're going to take a couple of clarifying questions right now, not necessarily comments, but clarifying questions, and then when we're all done with all three presentations, we'll have more general discussion. Rhonda.
Yeah, clarifying questions. in your measures, use and continuity of antipsychotic medications, and also follow-up after hospitalization, does that include medical follow-up or follow-up by medical physicians in your definitions? I'm looking at the ACO models of the future and whether or not individuals who have schizophrenia who just came out of the hospital, even though it's a psychiatric hospitalization, may be, not to my happiness, but maybe managed by primary care physicians in some way. So I'm just trying to understand whether or not your measures have that in there.
So the use and continuity measures are specifically looking at antipsychotic medications with the medication possession ratio. So it's only based on pharmacy claims, okay? So it's what's in the claims, and we don't actually know who prescribed it sometimes. But the follow-up after hospitalization for schizophrenia, we've had a long discussion about whether visits to other providers besides a mental health specialist should count in that follow-up. And we did not change from what has been in the HEDIS specification for a long time, which is it needs to be a mental health specialist. I think our experts really believe that if someone is ill enough to be in the hospital for schizophrenia, they should be followed up by a mental health specialist. Tom.
Question on the definition of evidence basis. I come out of a medical model, so I understand that kind of evidence basis. But what about for the social sciences? They've got a much more descriptive term that would not be acceptable in medicine, but it's the fundamentals there. How does that jive?
Okay, so you're right at the border of where we're we're experiencing this in a number of our projects. So right on the medical side, where we're looking at effectiveness of the treatment, then what we're looking for are systematic evidence reviews, and that might be or consensus guidelines that are based on systematic evidence reviews. You know, that's the gold standard there. I think on the other issues, so I just had a conversation with one of my and so a number of these topics here, we were really trying to stick to that medical evidence approach, and or to try to provide the link so that where something like the evidence of that having a follow-up after a hospitalization, is that linked to readmissions? I'm not sure that there's a lot of evidence that specifically addresses that, but some of that is, just kind of common sense. Now, on issues like health literacy or patient preferences for care, eliciting patient preferences, so there we're actually building a different kind of evidence map that says why would this be important. And as I think about it, we're creating the logic that can argue for why this works. So it's similar to what we've done with measures about patient experiences. Okay, patient-centeredness, first of all, is one of the six domains of quality from the IOM. Right, we start from that. We look at patient experiences, and we look at information about whether patient ratings of care are related to outcomes that we care about, like adherence to medications, about changing providers and continuity. So we try to develop that kind of argument, but it's really a different kind of argument because you're not going to have a randomized trial that says if you're one of these, by meeting one of these criteria, you're going to lead to better improvements in outcomes, and we're going to randomize you to either having your preferences met or not. So that's one of the challenges in the way that we're thinking about approaching is to really say, okay, what do we value in care? How does this fit within the quality strategy? And how can we show the link that makes sense to get to that outcome? Where do we think that how this intervention or activity would help us get to an important outcome? So we have to draw the logic out and then show what we know about those logical patterns.
Just one last question. A common measure that's used in health plans that focus on behavioral health is community tenure, which is a measurement of how long a person remains in the community free of hospitalizations, ER visits, and remains in contact with the system. I'm curious as to whether or not one that came up, and if it did come up, why it didn't make your list.
So we looked at ED visits, and I believe It is. Emergency department utilization is a measure, and I don't think this specific topic came up, but I'm actually kind of intrigued about whether that would be relevant. I think we the piece I'm struggling with how to operationalize is the piece about in contact with the system, but certainly that seems to me like it would have some value. So thank you. I'll bring that one back.
Thank you so much. And we'll loop back around to this in the discussion, so hang tight if you don't mind, Sarah. Karen Sapuka, are you with us on the phone?
I am, yep. Can you hear me?
Yes. So Karen is a senior scientist with the Health Decision Research Unit at Mass General Hospital and an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School and also a member of the clinician work group, and that's how that's why we're taking advantage of her good nature and sharing with us today about medical decision making. So Karen, we have your slides up. Take it away.
Okay. So good morning. As you mentioned, my name is Karen Sapuka, and I'm at MGH. I also have an appointment at Harvard and receive salary and research support from the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision Making, which is on the middle bottom of the slide there. And what I was asked to talk about was patient-reported outcomes and both their importance in evaluating the quality of care and then also some of the challenges in assessing patient-reported outcomes of care. And as you just mentioned, I am involved in the advisory group on clinician performance measurement, so I do have a sense for the difficulty of the task you guys are undertaking. And I know one of the issues that kept coming up in our group was really the gap between the measures that we wanted to have and what was really available in the set of endorsed measures that we could choose from. And one of the biggest limitations, at least from my perspective, was the lack of measures that really tapped into patients, their experiences, their quality of life, their goals and preferences. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we sort of know about how to do these things, where we sort of are with the science, and hopefully, you know, some ways to help you guys prioritize some of the gaps that I'm sure you're finding. So my research is really focused on developing tools and metrics to help understand and improve the quality of medical decisions. And in large part, the way that I've taken to do this is by trying to engage patients and ensure their voice is heard. So if we go to the next slide, and then maybe click twice. I think you're on PowerPoint, so hopefully if you click twice, you've got a couple of clips here. And what I want to show is a couple of excerpts from work that we've done as we were working with patients to help understand and listen to them, you know, to figure out what's important to them, how their disease is impacting their lives, what their goals and concerns are regarding possible treatments that they might be facing, and what it's like to experience those treatments. So this little clip is from a woman who is preparing for a visit. She's newly diagnosed with breast cancer, trying to understand what her options are. And when we step back from some of these things, so this is when she says, I have two small children and want to live as long as possible. What are my options? I want to do everything possible. What's the impact for each option on 10-year survival or 20-year survival? And if you click again, hopefully this word information comes up. Clearly patients really need information. They want information. They want to understand their options, benefits, risks, and survival and other things that we currently do track and have good ways of collecting information about are critically important to them. But it's not the only thing. And if you click ahead, I don't know if it's two or three times to get to that next little section of clips from a patient. Here's another set of clips from one patient. This woman had metastatic disease and was had just found new spots on her liver with a recent scan and was really concerned about treatment. She didn't want to actually have treatment. But she also was really concerned with the relationship with her doctor, and that experience and that relationship was very important to her. So here are her issues on her mind as she was trying to think through this, and how does she bring this up with her doctor? I'm concerned that my desire to forego treatment is discouraging and frustrating for you, meaning her doctor. I want to watch this recurrence and check it in 3 months. If it's growing, then I'll consider treatment. But if it's not, then she kind of still wanted to just keep watching and waiting. Your support's important to me. Are you willing to support me in this alternative? So here, if you click again, it's just the word involvement hopefully will come up. And I think really, you know, thinking about patients' experiences, you know, what we're talking about really isn't the, you know, is the waiting room nice? Are there flowers there? But it really is, are you listened to? Do you have a good relationship with your healthcare team? And are you able to sort of bring up your concerns and issues in a way that they get addressed? And here she's really trying to figure out what's going on and negotiating how decisions get made and enacted and the importance of that relationship in doing that. So if you click a couple more times, we'll hopefully have the third little patient vignette. And here's a woman who's also with breast cancer and really struggling with that decision about chemotherapy. And the way she put it, you know, I'm afraid of chemotherapy. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand how poisoning my body can make me better. I need my immune system to fight the cancer, but chemo weakens my immune system. So here, you know, patients really need to be able to create a coherent story about why they're doing something in order to really get engaged and involved and be able to actually carry this out. And a lot of times in medicine, you know, what we're asking patients to do is take sort of an upfront cost, you know, have these treatments that are, can be debilitating and cause side effects for a potential longer-term benefit. And that's a really hard thing to ask people to do. So it's not always information that patients need, and it's not even necessarily a relationship with the doctor, but sometimes it's really just reconciling conflicting beliefs and having a way to help understand that, to help get this stuff on the table so that we can be working through these issues with our patients to help them move forward. And if you click through, it should say concordance. And what we mean by that is just being able to tailor treatments to patients' needs, goals, and concerns. So the next slide is talking about how these three themes, I think, really are reflected in lots of definitions of high-quality patient-centered care. I'm not going to go through that in much detail because I think people are pretty familiar with those themes. So the next slide should say outcomes that matter to people. And PCORI, which is the logo on the bottom, is a new institute. It's the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. It was set up by the recent healthcare legislation. And really the goal is, at PCORI, is to help make sure that we've got a good understanding of the benefits and harms of the kinds of treatments and tests that we're delivering so that we can inform decision-making for patients and consumers. And there's three different things that really, when we're thinking about patient outcomes, that we might be wanting to capture. The first are the outcomes that people notice and care about. And that survival clearly is a big one, but also functional status, symptoms, health-related quality of life. It also includes the extent to which the treatments reflect individuals' preferences, autonomy, their needs, and concerns. And it also includes patients' experience with care. So it's not just survival, and it's a little more than quality of life. It's sort of a big, rich thing, set of outcomes that we want to be capturing. So the next slide. Now, hopefully this is somewhat self-explanatory. You know, the importance of patient-reported outcomes, why do we need these? Well, patients are really the only source of information about many critical aspects of quality that determine quality. So, for example, if you take someone with knee osteoarthritis and you look at their x-ray, you might be able to see a bone on a bone, but you will have no idea what level of pain this person is in, what level of functioning they have, whether or not their osteoarthritis has gone to the point where they're no longer able to take care of their grandkids or, you know, perform their work. You really can only understand that if you ask the patients. So administrative data, the test results, and even provider reports are not always a good replacement for actually asking patients. And, you know, that's just, you know, at some point, you know, they're really the source of the data about many of the things that are really important. And the patient experience, as Sarah mentioned briefly, you know, it really is, in specific places, linked to clinical outcomes and reduced medical error. So the idea that if we're really focusing on having a good experience with care, that we actually end up with better quality care has been starting to be a growing evidence base that's showing that. So the next slide, and I know from the reports that you guys are familiar, obviously, with the CAPS family of surveys, and I figured I would just use these as a way to illustrate what is involved in sort of developing, in sort of designing and developing sort of high-quality patient-reported outcomes, particularly because the CAPS surveys are some of the few that are actually endorsed, so they're sort of available to be used. And hopefully people are familiar with them. It's obviously a family of surveys now. It's more than just one survey that is sort of comprehensive and evolving. So they do change over time and address different issues. And in this bubble on the right hopefully that you're looking at. You can see all the different kinds, or at least a sampling of some of the different kinds of CAP surveys that are available. And really, they do have patients evaluate their experiences with their healthcare. It's not a satisfaction survey. I think that might be the only thing I'll really try and focus on, the distinction between what patient satisfaction and then the patient experience of care. You know, satisfaction is often heavily dependent upon expectations. So high satisfaction is often not necessarily due to having a good quality process, but it's mainly just potentially due to people having low expectations to begin with. Experience is really tapping into things that should or shouldn't occur and that patients and families can more reliably report on. And just to give you an example of what that means in a survey, a satisfaction question might ask something like, well, how satisfied were you with your surgeon? Not at all satisfied to extremely satisfied. Whereas the CAP survey for surgical care would have a question that looks like this. So it's, did this surgeon or a healthcare provider from this surgeon's office give you easy-to-understand instructions about getting ready for your surgery? So something that patients really can kind of report on more so than this sort of overarching kind of satisfaction. And then it's also actionable if you get an answer from that, because, okay, maybe this piece of information or having this process or not having this process can be linked to better or worse outcomes. So next slide, the design principles in here, this is just for an example. I think a lot of patient-reported outcomes or good survey research methodology focuses on this kind of approach. And first is the emphasis on patients. So clearly they're taking what patients value with respect to the setting and experience of care as the core content and the core domains. And as Sarah had mentioned earlier, there's not a lot of randomized trials about whether or not, certain aspects of the experience are extensively linked to different outcomes, but there's sort of a growing body of evidence that can compare different kinds of delivery systems and trying to tease out which of these pieces might be associated with it. It's asking patients, obviously, to report and rate their experiences with care. There is a standardization, and this is more than just using the same survey, but as Sarah was mentioning, the sampling procedure, how do you identify patients in the sample? What's the timing of the assessment? Who does the assessment? Is it, it's on-site or is it actually by a third party? And standards for the analysis and reporting of the data, as well as for benchmarking, so that we can help interpret and understand what these results mean. There are multiple versions, not only for the different kinds of healthcare settings, but also for different populations. And the development process, this again actually looks a little bit like what Sarah was talking about when they were doing their measure development. For CAPS, they start with the literature review, technical expert panel review, and often there are consumers or patients on the panel. Focus group feedback to make sure that the key domains and content areas are covered. Cognitive testing, so for surveys, when you're asking patients to answer questions, having the cognitive testing where you actually sit down with the patient, watch them go through the survey, and then ask them to reflect on their answers and what they understood the question to mean, what their answers mean. And then field testing and psychometric analysis to determine reliability and validity in different samples is obviously very important as well. Now, the next slide, I want to just kind of give you guys an example concretely of some of the challenges of doing patient surveys. And this is an example from an area that I'm very familiar with because most of my research is around decision-making. And one question that is often asked in studies of decision-making gets at how involved patients were in the decision. And they ask a variant of a question like this one. Who made the decision about treatment of your ... your knee osteoarthritis, your breast cancer? And the responses are often, they might have a little bit more, but often collapse into three categories at the end. Mainly the doctor, both equally, or mainly you. And hopefully if you just advance once, you'll have a first patient response when we ask them, well, tell me a little bit about the interaction with your doctor. What happened? So this woman said, well, they didn't say to me, well, we could remove the breast, we could do this, we could do that. They just said, this is what we're going to do. I wasn't in on the decision. That's what I'm trying to say. I wasn't in on the decision. So here a situation which is, in our interpretation, mainly the doctor was making this decision. They came in, made a recommendation, and the patient followed it. And if you click again, hopefully we'll get another vignettes, and here's another woman talking about how she made her decision. And it looks a little different. In her responses, she said, well, I made the decision. I'm very happy with that because that's what I wanted to do from the beginning. It was fine. They, meaning my doctors, didn't disagree. They didn't agree. They just said, okay, they understood. So she came in with a very strong opinion about what she wanted to do, told her doctors, and they said, fine. So really one that is more of a patient-driven, mainly the patient was making the decision about treatment. And then if you click again, hopefully you'll get to a middle ground here, which was a very different kind of conversation when this patient was discussing what happened with her doctor. So she, the doctor, was competent and compassionate. She gave me the data I needed to take the emotion out of the decision. We talked statistics and sizes and things that helped me be analytical with my decision. So here, really, a shared process. There's the difference in back and forth. And really, probably the first one of these three that I would say would, you know, really be considered both equally. Now, if you think about it, you know, hopefully that's how they answered the question. But if you click again, what we found when we looked at their survey was that all three of these women actually checked off the box both equally. And so just the challenge of, you know, trying to figure out what patients can and can't reliably report on, and, you know, thinking through, you know, clearly we want to understand who made the decision about their treatment, but what kind of questions do we need to ask in order to make sure that we get there? And that's one of the challenges in creating these kinds of surveys. That's something that I think, you know, people have come very far in figuring out how to do and how to do that well. So the next slide, just to sort of sum up, certainly some of the challenges, we need high-quality surveys to cover these critical areas. There certainly are some available. But I think, as Sarah mentioned, you know, there's certainly lots of different surveys available, but not all of them have been developed with an eye towards performance measurement or, you know, having these as part as a different kind of approach as opposed to using them in the part of routine care or as part of clinical care. I think another challenge with thinking about patient-reported outcomes, and especially the kinds of outcomes where we're trying to understand the extent to which patients' goals and preferences are driving decisions and are reflective of the decisions, is, you know, what if patients don't want the most effective care? What if they want something different than the clinical guideline or different than the consensus opinion? Then what do we do? And what happens if some of our measures are actually focused on those clinical guidelines? When is it okay to differ? And how do we build in a set of measures that don't squash patients before they really get a start? And then again, I think as Sarah mentioned many times, you know, this type of information isn't collected as part of routine care. It's not available in administrative data sets. And I think one of the big barriers and hurdles is a feasibility issue. You know, so it's not available. How do we make this available? How do we make sure that we can get this? If we think it's, you know, really critical to understanding and evaluating the quality of care, which I would argue it is. So the next slide. I think there is, you know, a lot of attention to this, and I think things are changing a little bit, specifically in how we're defining the appropriateness of care. So this is an example, it's an excerpt from the American Heart Association, their guidelines for revascularization. Really recognizing that appropriateness does not equate to medical necessity. And what that just means is that, you know, just because someone's clinically appropriate for something doesn't mean they should have it. So shared patient physician decision making for many scenarios would be expected and may result in patient deferring coronary revascularization while maintaining medical therapy. So thinking through, if this is the kind of guidelines that we're moving towards, how would we measure whether or not we were actually achieving this and doing these kinds of care? And just want to leave you with a couple of questions for you guys to be thinking about as you're, you know, setting your criteria. And I know these have already been in the thoughts and the discussions. And with that, I will just break. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen. Again, we have time for a couple clarifying questions, and I have one right off the top of my head. Yesterday, we talked about that there are CAHPS health plan surveys, one for Medicaid and one for Medicare health plans, but there's not really a dual integrated care model, care plan. I think Sarah brought up that the challenge that they're working through in respect to that earlier. So, you know, what are your thoughts about if we, you know, we're trying to pick out a survey among CAHPS that would be most representative of the needs of duals?
I think that's a great question. I'm not sure I'm immersed enough in the needs of the doulas to be able to answer that. So I think, you know, I think that there's a gap there. Without a certain survey that's really addressing your needs, I mean, I think what would be good is to figure out what are the domains that aren't in that you guys would think would be important, and then how do we kind of get some items that would be cover that.
I haven't thought about that. Yeah, Sarah's going to comment on that.
Yeah.
So actually, I would go to those domains because there's a number of supplemental sets in the CAPS family of surveys that where I think actually if you identify the domains that you think are important, certainly the access communication domains are common to all the surveys in some form or another, and those seem relevant. Now, I know that care coordination is a huge issue, and I was just we look for new items to add to the patient-centered medical home version. In fact, I think the patient-centered medical home version is probably better than the existing core sets for the duals population. But I wonder if there might need to be additional ones. We just submitted a paper with I worked with the CAPS team on that measure, and the reviewers asked, why don't you have more measures about care coordination? It's actually really hard to ask a general population about care coordination because most people have no experience of it. So when you ask, did you get help? Did you need help from somebody for managing your care? And then did you get help managing it? You know, you drop everybody out because they don't really perceive that they have a need because they have no idea that somebody would do that for them. And in the duals population, you're probably more used to that, and so you could get a better set of questions. And we actually tested those. They just didn't work in our general, you know, even in a chronic disease population that we tested with. So I think actually looking at what's in the core in the core surveys, and then also thinking about what's in the supplemental sets. And there's probably room for development of new items, particularly around care coordination. And maybe, you know, we're looking at items that get at things like are your preferences, how are your preferences included. That's, and then also kind of self-management, your help with managing your work, I think, is your health and your health care. There are new items in the CAPS CCMH version on that I think are good, but you could probably go further in this kind of population. And there are behavioral health items in the PCMH version that I think might be relevant to this population.
That's helpful. Thanks, Deb. Hi, this is Deb Potter from ARC. Karen, I wanted to thank you for the nice overview on CAPS, first of all. Just a couple of things about CAPS. One of the differences between the Medicare and the Medicaid plan versions is the reference period. And they changed the reference period for the Medicaid population to a shorter period because given the literacy of the population, that was what worked better for that population. I'd also point out that there's a couple of other supplements that might be useful for the duals. There's a supplement for people who have lower limb disabilities, and they're developing, and I'm not sure where they are in the process, a health literacy supplement.
Thanks. Any other clarifying questions for Karen? Okay, Karen, if you can stay on the line, we're going to have Heidi talk next. And Heidi, if you can speed through yours so we still have several minutes for general conversation, that would
be
great. Thanks.
Happy to. I will go through these fairly quickly. I think I've presented, maybe I haven't to this group. I think I have, yeah. So I've been asked to just go through our consensus development process and give you a sense of how we maintain the currency of our set, how measures are evaluated, and again, these are the types of things that I know Sarah thinks of as she, and you'll hear me kind of mirror the other side of what she was saying. As she develops measures, we take a look at it and evaluate them very similarly. So again, just want to emphasize, measurement facilitates improvement. It is not the be-all, end-all, but we do find that it's useful for consumers, for them to determine high quality, as well as for providers for their quality improvement activities as well. Give you a sense of where we sit. Again, I think you've seen this slide probably before. This gives a sense of the quality measurement enterprise. And measure development really sits between the priorities and goals and the standardized measures, and our endorsement process really fits within the standardized measures component. We try very strongly to stay out of the development piece, but rather advise on where we need to head next and where we think measures should really focus in the future. So toward that, we're driving toward higher performance, of course. Shifting toward composite measures really gets a feeling that these slices that look at small pieces or processes of care really don't start showing the quality of care that's provided, so well, composite measures are one way to approach it. Harmonizing measures across sites and providers, it's amazing how one bullet point looks so simple, but it's probably the thing that we spend the most amount of time on. Looking at across patient-focused episodes, I have a slide on that next, and then measuring disparities in all that we do, and Helen, I know, discussed that a little bit, and you heard that at the last meeting. Our work on that. So again, looking at the patient-focused episode model, we're really trying to frame the measures in our projects as we do begin to look at this within those models, promoting shared accountability, longitudinal measurement, again, outcome measures, appropriateness measures, nothing new to all of you, cost and resource use measures. That's a new area that we've just endorsed our first set of measures. Four measures were endorsed in the last month, and then we have another set going to our board, I would say, in April. But this is a new area, very complex, not easy to look at, and so we're beginning to endorse measures in that. The next step will be coupling that with quality measures and starting to look at efficiency. So ensuring the currency of the measures, there are three avenues. One's our endorsement maintenance process. One is our annual updates, and then we have ad hoc reviews, and I'll walk through each of those. So the endorsement maintenance process is really looking at the current portfolio of 750 measures. I may have it wrong. I think that's changed in the last week. but looking at that and also bringing in new measures. So in the last year, we started new projects that actually have maintenance of measures as well as calls for new measures at the same time in a clinical topic area. Again, trying to begin to look at implementation comments for those that are actually being used right now, bringing that back to the committee and to the developers. I think that's really important that they get that information. Reviewing all the measures against the criteria. The criteria continues to evolve. So as it does evolve, we need to make sure that the measures that are in the portfolio still meet those criteria. And then, the biggest challenges is harmonizing and endorsing best-in-class measures. Something, again, looks very simple, takes a huge amount of time, and we still haven't yet, I think, tackled all the big issues on that, specifically on best-in-class. So our current process is we take all the information from the priorities, the high-impact conditions. We have roughly 22 committees. That's evolving over time, but that's what we have at the moment, that meet every 3 years. And the steering committee reviews all of the measures, both new and those undergoing maintenance, against the four criteria. We'll use technical advisors or work groups if needed, given the volume or the type of measures we're looking at. They go out for comment with the draft recommendations on whether endorsement should continue or there should be endorsement. Goes out for voting, and then to our consensus standards approval committee and the board, and then they are indeed endorsed. And we have always appeals at the end. Every measure is evaluated against these criteria. So the first one is importance to measure and report, and what is the level of the evidence for the measures? Is there an opportunity for improvement? And then the relation to a priority area or a high-impact area. As Sarah mentioned, the evidence piece is something that we have constantly looked at. We actually had a task force specifically rework and provide additional recommendations on how we look at evidence, so it looks at the quantity, quality, and consistency of the evidence. Something, again, that's a challenge in some of the areas like care coordination. So we're trying to figure out how we work with developers to make sure that we have the information we need at the time of review. Opportunity for improvement, again, that might be variation across providers or just overall poor performance. Scientific acceptability, that's looking at reliability and validity of the measures. So is it precisely specified? When they tested it against the data in that data source, was it found to be reliable and valid? This is something that continues to evolve over time, especially as we start looking at measures specified for electronic health records. Usability is actually in the process of changing. So right now, it looks at whether the results are meaningful and understandable. Our task force that we had convened over the last year are actually recommending it looks more at the use and the usefulness. So are the measures that are in use and where are they, and have they been able to demonstrate that they're useful to different, the intended audiences? That should hopefully go to the board. Actually, it's going on Friday, so we should have an answer on that pretty quickly. Feasibility, again, is looking to see, can we make sure that we collect the data without undue burden, and then assessing related and competing measures. So anytime we have anything that measures a similar aspect of care or is a really an identical measure, the committee is asked to take a look at that and determine if they can recommend harmonization or a best-in-class measure. Annual updates. This is, again, ensuring that we have accurate and current data. So all developers are asked to send in information on specification changes, numerator, denominator changes, not the whole entire application, but again, just on the specifications more. This may actually initiate an ad hoc review, which I'll go over in just a minute. But all measures are actually put through an annual update unless they're in a full maintenance review. Ad hoc reviews, this is something that we've taken care of in the past in a different way, but we formalized the process now, where we can actually conduct a review when we think there's adequate justification at any point in time on a measure. We actually have one going through right now that are immunization and pneumococcal measures that have been expanded to a different setting, use a different data source. And so because of that, we felt that we needed a small group to take a look at that and make sure that the changes were consistent with the criteria. So those can occur at any point in time. Often when we see an expansion, and ideally for the measures that I think you all are looking at, if they did get expanded, we have an avenue to bring that back through and look at it fairly quickly. So just to let everyone know, we're trying to get the word out as much as possible. We've received some feedback on the current process. And so a lot of the developers have been asking to get an earlier decision on the importance criterion. We're finding about one-third of the portfolio, when it goes through maintenance or if new measures coming in, are actually not passing importance, and it is a must-pass. So we've taken a look at that, and then we've also been asked to look at if there's a way to have a more timely and flexible review of fully specified and tested measures. Right now, we can guarantee every 3 years that the topic area may come up, but frankly, it's 3 years is a long time when you're in the development business. So we are in the process of redesigning, potentially, how we look at our and review the measures against the consensus development process, and we're proposing a two-stage process. And I'm just going to move to the next slide because I think it's easier to look at it this way. So just want you to know that part of this is to try to provide feedback more readily to developers on when they start to develop a measure concept. We'll focus on importance to measure and report. We've discussed whether usability actually would fit within here. We're trying to determine if there is a way to do that. The developers would submit the concept, which is the numerator, denominator, and exclusion information, all the information against the importance criteria, so the impact, the opportunity for improvement, and the evidence base, and there would be basically an approval provided to them. Part of this is to try to get to, we don't want developers to spend money and resources, time, on things that won't pass the importance criterion. We also want to provide the input from consumers and purchasers and the full NQF membership, so that they get that input early rather than later, after they've invested time and money. And then stage two would be they'd have up to 18 months, we're thinking at the moment, to come back with a fully specified and tested measure. Just wanted you to know that's an option. I think some of this is also to help us identify issues that if they went for a narrow population that really should be a broader population, that's an opportunity to ask for them to look at it then. We think there are a lot of ways where we may be able to get to measures that are looking at more perhaps broader populations, again, or looking at more specific populations that may relate to duals in a more easy fashion where we're telling and advising developers up front of the issues that we think may be coming forward rather than later on when they've gotten all the way through, tested, and specified the measure. I think that was all I have. Yeah.
Thank you. We'll go ahead, unless there's like any burning clarifying issues for Heidi. I think that was pretty straightforward. We'll go ahead and open it up to all three of you to questions. And the first question I would have is, in our looking at the list of potential measures that we're going to prioritize today. Do you have any kind of general observations, the three of you, about, you know, we have measures that we like, but we wish it was in a different setting. We have measures that we like, but we wish the population was broader. In terms of your ad hoc process, is that something that, you know, we can just, if the committee agrees that we wish it was a more broadly applicable measure, we can just say so in our report to HHS and cross our fingers?
Well, I can tell you from the NQF perspective, and then Sarah and Karen can give you perhaps from the developer perspective. I think that's a great idea. I think that feedback is very useful to developers. It may take them some time to figure that out. So, again, it's one of those things where some of this is the timing, the resources. But I do think it is very helpful both to us at NQF as well as to the developers to know where you think there may be either gaps or areas that should perhaps be expanded and looked upon. So I think that's helpful. You may find that you're very limited in what you can put in a core set at this moment because of that, but I think that's also an important message to send.
So measures are developed, or in our experience, we develop measures for specific programs or activities. So every measure that we develop, we have an idea of where it's going to be used and what's going to be the data source and who's going to be accountable. And so that's why we have a lot of health plan HEDIS measures, right, because that's been our business is to do that. And now we have more and more measures that are specified at the doctor level. But sometimes a measure that you so as we're thinking about how can we apply this in a different setting for in a different population, we have to go through all of these same kinds of thought process of saying, okay, is the evidence base, does it fit that other population, or would we have to change the numerator? Would we have to change the measure a lot to actually expand that denominator population? We have to think about, okay, does this measure really make sense at a provider level? We were asked to specify measures from the child core set, with health plan measures like timeliness of prenatal care for provider level. Okay, so which provider is responsible for early prenatal care? Is it the OBGYN that has the patient? Is it the primary care provider who saw the patient? Is it the, you know, so you have to really think about how does accountability work? And are you really fundamentally changing the measure when you expand the population or you apply it to a different setting? Those are the kinds of things that we would be looking at. Do we still have an evidence base to support an expanded group? So I'm looking at this comment that says expand the follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness to incorporate substance use disorders and detox. So then I want to say, okay, so does that mean we change it and they have to have follow-up treatment, you know, at substance abuse facilities? Is that the normal way treatment is provided? So we'd have to walk through all of those issues and think about who's the accountable entity, what are the data sources, does the evidence really line up, or would we really be fundamentally starting a new measure?
That's what I was wondering, when does it turn into a completely new measure? Tom?
Thank you. I guess I'll throw this one to Heidi because she wasn't on the health plan council call. The issue of the definition of importance at a health plan level was one where it became that of impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had some discussion with Helen about what is impact as opposed to importance in the usual sense that NQF has defined it. But when we're starting to talk about the dual eligibles, where we have a population that is defined by how they are covered as opposed to other characteristics, how would you use the term importance for dual eligibles? So I think that's going to come up as we do these.
I still think it goes back to what you're trying to measure. So regardless of, unless you have a measure that's specifically to dual eligibles, then they have to demonstrate how that would impact. I think it still goes back to the population that you're trying to measure. And the impact doesn't have to be large numbers. It can be other things like it has a significant impact on comorbidities, or mortality, it has an impact on quality of life. That, again, can be, I think, this is where the impact is, in some ways we view it as somewhat squishy because it's not as concrete, but in other ways it's probably a good thing because it allows you to have those measures that look at the more unique areas.
All humans are squishy.
Yes. So we're right in line. Yes.
Thanks, Jim.
I have a more off-the-wall question. Since a lot of the social determinants are dynamic and the clinician needs to know information, do you ever see a time when we're going to have a patient-reported outcome measure that could be done by patients on cell phones or in a way that would be much more mobile and take advantage of sort of social networking to be able to kind of get a more informed real-time view of what's going on?
Yeah, we're actually talking about this. We have a Center of Excellence in Pediatric Quality Measurement, and we're looking at adolescents and risk factors that adolescents observe. And for adolescents, cell phones and texting may be the best way to get that group of kids involved. So in getting any information directly from them. That's the only way I talk to my teens. So we're actually really thinking about that. I think the issue gets to how do you incorporate that into the measurement process? And we're really, you know, we've had the same questions about how do we get the information when we're thinking about people with dual eligibility. Okay, so you know, could it be kind of like the UPS guy with the you know, that you get one of the, whatever it is they use to track all the packages, or the way Walmart tracks packages and stuff? Is there a way that we could use those new technologies to actually get better information, more frequent assessments, and use that information? Now, I don't think that, and I don't think I said this, I don't think it's really going to be fair at this point in time to use outcome measures like does your quality of life improve in your dual population and report that publicly for these entities now. But I think having a structural expectation that organizations that are responsible for people with dual eligibility track those things at a certain interval and that they react when those things, when there's a kind of tipping point, I think that is an expectation. And that type of measurement, we're seeing this happen in depression care. So so there are NQF endorsed measures that are looking to see whether people are screened, whether people are a standard tool, the PHQ-9, the 9 symptom checklist, whether that is used for monitoring care. And then you play that out to see whether outcomes improve after 3 or 6 months. And then, you know, the next step is a measure that looks at whether treatment was intensified, changed, you know, added. Somehow did somebody react when somebody didn't get better? So that kind of approach is what we're starting to see in the medical side. You know, that's kind of the logic behind A1C control measures, right? Or blood pressure control measures. And now we're starting to see that kind of thinking applied in behavioral health care. And that's kind of that's one of the things that we want to explore in our work on duals, is to see whether that approach to tracking preferences, symptoms, functioning, choices over time would allow us to begin to say, you know, this is what you should expect in an organization that's serving. It may be that that information is most useful for the organization to use for quality improvement and for tracking their patients, rather than saying, you know, 50% of our patients had a 15% improvement in quality of life over a 6-month period. I just don't know that that's really what we want or useful. But knowing what percentage did and what you did with the people that were starting a decline, I think would be really important. So that's kind of what we're thinking. And it will require new technologies. Thanks. Deb.
One of the aims of the healthcare quality strategy is to reduce costs, and we haven't really talked about any measures in that. And Heidi, you mentioned that there were now 4 endorsed measures. I wonder if you could speak a little more about that.
Oh, now I'll have to pull them up. I can't. I've lost track, to be honest, of which ones they are. But we do have it. There are several that look at. Again, they don't get to the provider level because there are significant challenges in getting to that. But we do have one that's endorsed on total cost for patients. At any point in time, kind of looking within a year's span. And then we are in the process of looking at several more condition-specific. So we've got the non-condition-specific, and then we have condition-specific, including diabetes. There are several cardiovascular measures, as well as, I think, one looking at hip fracture. So those are under consideration or are currently endorsed. They look at very narrow slices for the most part, but they, again, that's one of the challenges of trying to get cost and resource use is really trying to capture what that episode or that longitudinal piece would be, which is a challenge. But right now it's a very small set, but it's also an area where we will have another project hopefully starting in the next few months, looking at even more cost and resource use measures.
Samantha, you were up and are you down now?
I wanted to learn more about the cost measures.
Okay, good. All right, Jenny?
Picking up on the cost measure, I think this last point is really, for me, quite exciting to think about, say, even the period of time of a year. So do you, as you get more experience, you imagine kind of doing it over a longer cycle? And the reason I reference that is, you know, in PACE programs, oftentimes it used to be that people's length of stay was over the course of, say, about 3.5-4 years. So when we look at that total cost period, it gives a different picture of the ups and downs rather than just 1 year, especially year one, as compared to the last year. But if you take it over a period of time, that is very informative, and the accountability that you have during that time, you know, allows for that flexibility to do the best by that person. So I wonder if that's something kind of in the background of thinking.
It hasn't yet come up to date in any of the work that I'm aware of, and I can ask our staff to be sure. Some of the challenges are because you're looking at claims data, you need to be able to track that patient across multiple years if you're going to do it that way, and the fact that many patients, and again, I'm not as familiar with the dual eligibles, maybe this isn't as much of an issue, they leave the health and the programs. So you have to be able to track a patient across multiple health plans and then aggregate the claims if you're going to do it that way. That has challenges. But if you have a pretty stable population, then yeah, I think you definitely could do that. I think part of the issues are we don't have that at the moment.
Sure. Yeah. I had other quickies on that. And your other comment about, I think what Tom and you were talking about, the importance vis-a-vis impact, and I think I heard you say that in some of the impact aspects, it didn't have to be as large of a number, and that's of great interest also because when we're touching the areas of comorbidity in particular, and then I think about a discrete measure like A1C, so an A1C number for a 90-year-old who has other conditions, that management of the A1C criteria may be then different and accepted being higher than norm, and how that will factor in when you look at that kind of complexity side. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, that's probably more where you get to the scientific acceptability and how you specified the measure rather than the importance piece. Because the importance looks at the clinical topic area, what you're trying to measure overall.
Yes.
And probably the complexity you just mentioned is one reason why they wouldn't include those patients or they'd find a way to risk adjust
right,
to be able to address those issues. So I think it's what you're outlining is a little bit more into when you start specifying who the appropriate population is or how you factor that in, that's
right.
Probably more where you find it.
Right.
Importance tends to be more broad.
Oh, okay. The last question was, yes, actually it was Rhonda's comment on community tenure in behavioral health, and it just went as a light bulb for me personally when I was saying yesterday, and I wasn't articulating it well, that perhaps the goal of the person is to maintain a steady state, you know, and this is a behavioral steady state, but in some ways a frail population, they're best living well without all these, you know, dramatic variances to have to measure readmission and all of that. If there is any way to kind of put our arms around that concept.
Yeah. Thanks. David.
Okay. My question is more of a process question. I'm currently working on another NQF panel where we're going through some of the process. I guess it's probably mostly for you, Heidi. Through the process of final approval of measures, and we're interacting with the measure developers directly in order to try to see whether the concerns that the panel has around measures can be addressed by the measure developers before we approve them. Here we're in a very different place where we're reviewing measures that were really developed for a different purpose. So we like the topics, and we think they need, in most instances, major or wholesale reworking in order to be applicable. And if we were going to follow that process, we might stop our work at identifying the topics that we think form a complete slate, and then let developers go at that. But this seems to be sort of a hybrid. I guess I'm trying to understand how we get there here, and what the plan is.
So what we're looking for from this process is really the roadmap, the strategic plan. What's important to measure? How do we measure it? And we talked a little bit about measurement concepts that were very important yesterday. And then there may be specific measures under that hit those concepts. And I think the process we've been going through is we've identified an overarching roadmap, and now we're looking more at those measurement concepts. What is important for this population so that we're measuring key elements and really only those key elements so we're not also creating additional burden. We're looking at things that exist now that maybe we can just stratify, and that's one thing. And then the other thing I think we're looking at is, what do we need going forward? What should we do going forward? One thing to look at is, here's some existing measures which get kind of close, and we like them, and they fit within our measurement concepts, CMS, HHS, please look at this. And then we would take that and work with measure developers on, is it a new measure? Is it taking a measure that exists and making it a little bit different? What is it that people like about it so we can create the right measure in the future? It may take a little while, as people have indicated, but what is the right measure? Give us some, I think we're looking at specific measures because that helps us with the more specific the wants and needs of this group are and can be articulated to us, the more likely we are to stay on that right path. So, and then there are things that we're looking at, there's just nothing exists. So I think it's not that we're looking at specific measures for people to embrace those measures and say these are perfect. It's just a way for us to anchor our thinking and be more specific and provide more specific recommendations to us. So what we plan to do after this process is over is take the lists and say, hey, here are some that exist and are pretty good and we could stratify, and the group recommends that we stratify for this particular group. Here are concepts everybody really likes or that were recommended to us. And here are specific measures, and here's what they like about them and don't like about them, and the pros and cons, and how do we then take that and go forward with creating something that works? So we have specific information about how to do that and how to do that in a way that in a few years, if we bring it back to this group, you would say, yeah, you guys got it pretty close, as opposed to, yeah, that's not really what we meant at all. So it's really getting that specificity, and my measurement folks at CMS highlight how important that is to keep us on track. To say, like this about that measure, don't like this about this measure. This measure's good, but it doesn't hit the age group. Or as Kara and Giannis were saying, there were some measures they really, really liked, but they essentially in the specifications excluded all duals. So you can use them. There's a reason they excluded all duals, but we can at least say, hey, we like the measure. There's a reason that duals were excluded. What was that reason, and how do we address it, either in creating a new measure or amending the measure that exists? And then there's a whole group of things that we've identified that there just isn't anything there. But again, the specificity that we can get to and how we take those and go forward with them is very helpful to make sure that we stay on track. So I think of what we're doing as it's creating the roadmap and the strategic plan for Duals measurements to make sure that we're getting what's important and we're measuring it correctly. And all of your input and getting to going there and moving forward. Does that help?
Yep. That helps. Adam, Steve, and then we're going to move to the next topic. So thanks.
A question for Sarah, just to return to your presentation, the very beginning of your presentation. First, I very much like the priority domains that were identified. I think those three priority domains pretty much capture everything that we have said is important in this work group. Then you went on to define certain constraints in measuring these. For example, that you have to have in place the health information technology that allows people to do this in a defined way, allows you to then assess it and measure it. Then later when you work with the schizophrenia population, they had identified a constraint, which was it has to be from claims data. How will you contend with those kinds of constraints? And is it necessary to wait until health information technology is in place and has some consistency before you start to measure these things?
That's a great question. So actually, when I think about the work that we're doing in our grant on Duals, I think we're actually specifying a model of care. And we're saying, we are kind of laying out, you got to have this, because if you don't have this, we won't be able to get to that measure you want us to do. So we can't do, there are ways to get around those kinds of constraints, right? So we could just do a survey of everybody who is who has dual eligibility, kind of the way that we do a Medicare Advantage today, right? And then we'd go back 2 years later. But are we going to really? I mean, are the people that are really frail going to respond? Who's going to respond? How can we use that information? I just don't know how we do it. So it's actually a balance. It will have to be a balance. In this grant, we have the freedom to say, okay, we're thinking through this model. This is how we are laying out the systems that need to be in place to develop the measures that we want to evaluate. Because we're doing it through a grant, we're imagining. Now, if a state, and we're trying to imagine in a way that it can be useful to states, but when we think about how could this actually be used, how would these measures be used by CMS or by states, then we'll have to get down to the, okay, who's the entity and what's the measures? And some of the measures are closer to being ready for adoption with existing data than others. The constraint of we need this quality improvement infrastructure and we need the electronic data system, some kind of data system that's really about measuring care coordination and measuring patient, all this information that we want to get about patient preferences and exceptions. If that work is not, and whether, and outcomes. If there's not a way to measure that, that's part of the model of care, I think we're going to be really, we won't have the measures. We've been trying to do this on care coordination, and, you can't see that information exchange if it doesn't happen. So in some ways, we're laying out the structures and processes so that we can begin to get to measures. It's very similar to what we've done in our patient-centered medical home program and the measures that we're building now for EHRs. In the medical home program, we have an expectation about, we've articulated structures and processes that practices need to do to track referrals.
Okay? So that allows us now, we're working on measures that specify whether that communication happened and whether the referral information came back to the provider. So it's, we see it as a kind of a long-term effort to try to build the systems we need for better quality measurement in the future. If we want to start with the data systems we have today, we're going to start with administered claims data, and we're going to start with once-a-year surveys that may not be so useful. I mean, that will have limited, I mean, that can provide information that are going to be useful, less, they aren't going to capture all the topics that you've talked about.
I think that's helpful. So, as I understand it, you know, your work is going to actually guide the specifications for, the technical specifications for those information platforms that can then be used for program quality and for measurement. What's the time frame of that process?
Long term? Well, it's not a year. It's not a year. Is it 10 years? I hope not. So I think we're thinking, we're actually working at this really great opportunity in time when states are trying to develop these systems. So I didn't want you to think that, you know, we're often imagining this. We want to work with states to see how close we can get to what exists now. I mean, to be having something that could be implemented by states that are doing their demonstrations, and so, but we want to recognize that the infrastructure for measurement, I don't think exists right now. And if we don't build the infrastructure, we won't get to the measures that we want. Stephen, and then really we just have to move on, or we'll be here forever.
I'm interested. The neurological populations so often have literacy issues as well as cognitive impairment, dementia, Alzheimer's disease. How do you handle development of measures around patient experience for those individuals, which really make up a large portion of dual eligibles?
Yeah, that's one of my colleagues, Aaron Giovanetti, is here. We've been talking about this. In the CAP surveys, there are some proxy respondents in the HOS and other surveys. They're proxy respondents. Now, when do you want a proxy? When would that be adequate? Now, on the patient and for, if you're thinking about where you're really looking at experiences of care, who could respond? Because the family perspective could be different from the consumer. So one of the things that we're really going to be thinking about is trying to articulate when is a proxy acceptable, and how would you determine whether it's acceptable? The decisions about experiences of care may be very different from outcomes, where in an outcomes, if you're looking at something that about functioning and whether somebody can get in and out of bed, then you may it may be acceptable to have a staff person or the caregiver, right, professional caregiver, to do that kind of rating. And so we're going to have to, that's part of what we're going to be dealing with, is trying to think about who should be the respondent. If the subject can't respond, is it acceptable to have somebody else? And if so, under what circumstances? That's part of what makes this world really a challenge if we're thinking about duals that include frail elders, people with serious and persistent mental illness, developmentally disabled, you know, all those different groups. You might have different criteria, and we want cross-cutting measures that fit for all that group, but you still think about whether you need to report data out separately and acknowledge those differences.
Thanks. Very, very helpful to have you. And Karen, thank you too for being with us this morning. Very helpful to have your comments as well.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're going to quickly move to the presentation from the L&M Policy Research Group that helped with some analytic support for us. Okay. This was sent to you in advance of the meeting, so hopefully you will have already reviewed the comments at a high level, and we'll just have you guys present the
this the magic wand?
That's the magic wand.
Okay.
This is Lisa Green and Julia Doherty. Thank you.
And yep. Rachel Dolan.
Oh, and Rachel Dolan. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. We are so pleased to be here and also want to acknowledge Avalier Health, who we have the contract with, who has the contract with NQF for the MAP support. And my name is Lisa Green. I'm from a principal from L&M Policy Research, and we're a small health services and policy research up the road in DuPont Circle. And just wanted to sort of cut the chase. This is a nice opportunity to be in a crowd that is already fully versed in all the issues we're probably going to talk through today. We won't say anything wildly earth-shattering to you, but hopefully have pulled things together in a way that will make this pathway to finding a working set of dual measures a little more tidy, we hope. So the purpose here is really of this particular task was to look at quality measures and concepts that are specific to dual eligibles. And as I think Tom had mentioned earlier, the way duals are defined is not necessarily handy when it comes to developing measures. but we do our best and really try and focus on those areas and concepts that are critical and unique to duals as much as possible. So, I mean, theoretically, anything that's relevant to any population is also relevant to duals, but that's not helpful when you're trying to narrow the universe down to that critical set. So just generally, just to go over a few of the methods that we applied in this process of identifying some of these core concepts and even pulling together some measures that are relevant to some of these concepts. We worked from, of course, the work of the work group. To date, there's your interim report, and certainly we've been able to review a lot of the meeting discussion notes and things like that, and use that and certainly the reports from NQF as a starting point for us. These are the five high priority areas that have been already defined, and use that as our launching point. And the idea here was to pull as much information to kind of define the broad universe so that we can start to winnow down. And that included a literature review, an inventory of all of the reports and, like I said, all of the work that the work group has done to date. And this particular team has been in the field the past 2 or 3 years really focusing on duals and duals-related issues, looking at what are factors that drive cost and quality, care delivery, issues that are unique to duals and harder to reach populations. So we built upon our own experience, too, and we have lots of stories if anyone cares to hear about those. And of course, the meat of this, too, to provide kind of that face validity aspect to it, was to talk to experts. And for OMB reasons, we were restricted to 9. But some of you in this room were lucky winners, and we had an opportunity to talk to you guys as well, so in addition to others. So this is really just a little drill down, a couple of things on the methods. The interviews were, first we identified a list of the NQF-endorsed measures, and so that was sort of a broad universe of measures to look at. And we also looked more broadly at the AHRQ clearinghouse to see what exactly is out there so that as we're thinking through the concepts, we can think practically about leveraging measures that already exist. I think Cheryl did a very helpful job of framing what the process would be, is looking at things that might not be perfect but could be candidates or at least a starting point so that we're not starting from scratch every time just to see what's out there. And went through not a complex filtering process, but a what we think a well-reasoned filtering process that we won't get into today, but if anyone's interested in that process, we can certainly share it with you. And then we spoke with key informants, about an hour to an hour and a half discussions with some of you in the room, as well as others, and certainly worked in the literature review to make sure that we were identifying and considering the broad range of concepts, and overall, here we are presenting the work to this group, and this will all culminate in a report as well. Just to give you a list, some familiar names on here, these are the folks that we spoke with, and the thinking behind this group was really to get as a diverse set of perspectives as possible, state, local, federal, from different types of folks who are either on the ground, people who work with data, and just so that we could consider all of these broad perspectives, even within the limited range of the number of interviews that we had. So I'll turn it over to Julia and Rachel at this point to talk to you about what we actually came up with. Thanks, Lisa. I'm Julia Doherty, and this is Rachel Dolan. We are happy to be here this morning. And during this next segment, Rachel and I are going to be reviewing what we learned from those discussions. While there were just 9 different entities that we spoke with, there were about 25 people involved in those phone calls, including folks from the PACE Association, as you saw, as well as organizations that involved in special needs programs, states, and then other policymakers. So we spoke to quite a broad group of people, as well as looking back on our experience in meeting with many different kinds of providers throughout the country and site visits, looking at these cost and quality variations in around the country. What we're going to do is walk you through some examples of the available measures that we identified as measures for consideration, recognizing, of course, there'd need to be significant modification, that the denominator might have to be different, and that, of course, we need to really think about who would be accountable, what the accountable entity would be for any given measure. But what we did was we identified measure areas that the stakeholders whom we spoke with thought were particularly important. And we thought it would be useful for you today, before you go through this gaps analysis this afternoon, to just think from a slightly different perspective. This is a very large group that you've been talking with over the period of the MAPS process. What we did was speak with a much smaller group, sort of in more detail, to try to flesh out exactly what their concerns were and what they wanted to be sure somehow the measures took into account as they're evolving, because obviously we don't have a measure set we can just jumpstart and use out of the box. So while none of the findings that we relay to you there are likely to come as a surprise, we really believe it's going to be of value to get this perspective. In terms of the findings themselves, not surprisingly, as you'd imagine, what we found was that the group expressed specific areas of concern unique to their populations they were serving. If it was a given subpopulation, whether it would be the PACE folks or whether it would be the frail elderly or the people with special needs and developmentally disabled, et cetera, they had specific interests. But all of them basically came to the same general conclusion about how important it is to gauge the quality of care being delivered to this complex population, and that we really want to look at the extent to which the care being delivered is of course, patient-centered, and that we know who needs the care when and ensure that the care is delivered in such a way that the people that are the most vulnerable are getting what they need, and that the process and structures are in place and the measures encourage that continuous improvement to ensure appropriate delivery of care for this population. If you look at the next slide, it goes into more detail about the process that we had that Lisa mentioned, where we were filtering through all the measures that exist and then trying to identify the gaps and say where we'd like the measures to evolve. It was pretty much a parallel process to what you all have been involved in. And while we came up with a slightly different list than yours, each of the areas focus identified through our interviews are very similar to the areas that were important and identified through the MAPS process. Again, none of these are a surprise, but if you look at them, what you consistently see is a suggestion of the importance of systemness and coordination across settings, not just medical settings, community health, community settings, community service organizations, and the importance of sort of integrating service delivery and making sure that there's a patient focus on that service delivery. So if you go to the next slide, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it just sort of shows how the areas that our individuals spoke with, totally independent of the MAT, parallel the kinds of 5 leverage areas that the MAT has identified. And as you might expect with this kind of a complex population, any robust measure set is going to need to be multidimensional. And I don't want to spend too much time on this diagram, but as you know, Venn diagrams originally were designed in essence to sort of map out a simple set of relationships. Well, it's quite clear in dealing with the dual population that we're not dealing with a simple set of relationships. And that only further emphasizes the importance of of, you know, when you're looking at this, taking a multifaceted approach to deal with this really complex set of issues that need to be addressed to properly serve this population. I'd like to skip forward for a minute to the discussion questions that we're going to try to go very quickly now and get straight to the end to tell you what, where, you know, we were thinking it would be useful, but just the things that came up over and over and over again in our discussions with different interviewees and also in our experience in meeting with lots of different kinds of providers, from area agencies on aging to nursing homes to PACE programs, to social service departments, public health departments, was this problem around our system not really being a system and the lack of coordination across all these things and how absolutely critical that becomes for people with multiple complex needs who are frail, elderly, or have cognitive and functional challenges. So what are the key components that in the measures ultimately will get us that sense that will help us get closer to having a system, a true system? And then the second question, which came up repeatedly and we heard this morning again, is around care planning. Everyone talks about the need for a care plan. Well, but we've seen it even in visits that we've made to dialysis centers for very different reasons, that having to have a care plan for every single person, whether they need one or not, and whether they're in a position that care plan is going to make any difference, results in a huge burden to organizations while it takes away the focus from the particular individuals that need the care planning the most. So how do we go about identifying who needs a care plan, when and why, who's responsible, and then making sure that the measures we put in place are actually meaningful. Is the care planning meaningful, or are we just getting people to check boxes off? So those are the questions we'd like you to focus on a little bit. And at this point, Rachel's going to be providing you some examples of the measures and gaps. We're not going to spend a lot of time reading these off on slides for you, but just want to encourage you to think about those questions and then also to understand how what we've done here links to the memorandum that you all probably got and the many, many materials that you have that has an even more detailed list of the potential measures that are existing that are mostly endorsed that might be of value should they be adjusted to, again, reflect who's accountable and the importance of these sort of subsets of populations that are within the dual group. Rachel?
Thanks, Julia. As Julia said, I'll be referring to a memo that was passed around. I'm not sure if anyone has it in front of them, but it includes kind of a snapshot of some of the measures that we were looking at in more detail to kind of give this a more concrete feel. So I'm going to dive a little bit deeper into each of those seven areas that Julia had previously mentioned on an earlier slide and kind of talk about where the measures are related to those areas and where maybe they ideally should be or could be if we put our heads together a little bit. So the first one is the consumer-based assessment of goal-oriented planning and care delivery. I'm not going to dwell too much on this. We talked a lot about the CAPS measures, which if you look at the table in the memo, fill out a lot of what this area, this measure set could be about. We have obviously a lot of measures that take into account the consumer perspective, but they're not quite as comprehensive as we would like them to be. Obviously, with duals, as we said, the CAPS measures are good, but in some respects, when you're dealing with a very elderly population, people who have behavioral health issues, you're going to have some problems maybe filling out or understanding the questions in the survey. So ideally, those measures would take into account the consumer perspective and focus on really the team-building aspect, working patient and provider together across settings of care to either achieve the goals of the care plan or at the very least make the decision that a care plan is not needed for that individual. The next area that really was a focal point of discussions with the interviewees that we spoke with is management and monitoring of specific conditions and disabilities. Now, I think we all know that there really are a tremendous amount of measures out there, but it seems that the common theme we heard is the problem of single condition measures in single settings, specifically focusing on the acute care setting. So with duals, we all know one of the big problems is multiple chronic conditions and even care in a lot of different areas, a lot of different settings. So the ideal for this category would be to have only a few measures that focus on conditions that seem to present together in and looking at them across settings. So I think we spoke with someone who gave the example of if somebody comes in with diabetes, maybe it's a smart idea to make sure that the physician also sees whether they have depression and also some other behavioral health issues that in many instances will present with some of these chronic conditions. Well, medication management reconciliation across settings. Also won't dwell too long on this. I think everybody knows how important that is for particularly dually eligible beneficiaries. But, you know, the problem is there's typically no central repository where a doctor can go see if someone filled their prescriptions, when they filled them, and whether they're taking their medications. But ideally, the measures for this area would really focus on the interaction between provider and patient working together to manage those conditions. So one of the questions with duals is, do they understand why exactly they are taking the medications and what they need to do to really manage their conditions? As Lisa and Julia mentioned, we were out in the field, and I distinctly remember hearing a provider saying, I think it was in Louisiana, that they needed to explain to a patient that little white pill is going to make their heart beat. So it's things like that. If you don't understand why you're taking a pill, why would you take it? And obviously, duals have the problems of being able to go to the pharmacy and get the medication. So right now, as the measures currently exist, there are a lot of great starting points. There's a lot of medication reconciliation measures. But they focus on the acute care setting, and they don't necessarily follow the patient and make sure that the patient understands why they're taking the medication.
I'd like to add something. I mean, as we're talking about these things, we have a tendency of saying patient rather than person, because we all have been, those of us that have been involved in the medical side, think oftentimes of folks as patients, and you know, we're shifting obviously to try to think about the person as a whole. But this is a perfect area where it indicates, you know, the problems and challenges we have in terms of even the simple integration of behavioral or mental health issues and physical health issues, and those medications that folks are taking for different reasons are often prescribed by different organizations, and sometimes being followed or not by any one individual organization. And the problem oftentimes with these measures, although they're great measures, is that when we're trying to look at a population as a whole, how do we get a measure that's going to make sure that the different individuals that need to be accountable are even identified, who's accountable to ensure that they get the right medication when, or the right service or referral or whatever it is, even if it's not medical in orientation.
Thanks, Julia. So we can move on to the next area, which is transition management. I'm sure everybody here is not surprised that this made the list. It's a very important component of care, particularly when dealing with the dually eligible beneficiaries. There are actually a plethora of measures that we went through related to this topic, but again, they're confined to acute care setting, not working across multiple different kinds of settings, and they don't really necessarily incorporate the patient or the person into the measure set at all. They're very clinically oriented. So ideally, this would focus more on tracking the patient interactions with providers across different kinds of settings and the communication that is happening there. The next measure set is integration and coordination of community social supports and health delivery. This one's much trickier. It's not quite as straightforward as transition management or even medication reconciliation. This, as we found, there really aren't any measures. I'm sure it's not, that comes as no surprise, but we couldn't have a conversation about duals without talking about the coordination and integration of community social supports, because in many times those components, you know, transportation, housing, education, those things play just a role, just as big a role, if not more, in whether or not duals are receiving quality care. So we have a long way to go on these, but of course there is the problem of many of these things are not even covered benefits, so how can you hold a physician accountable for, or provider accountable for working on these issues? But even in the case of HCBS waivers, many physicians may not even be aware of the existence of those and aren't going to refer a patient to those services. So it really is a matter of this will obviously be down the line something that needs to be focused on, but we but currently the measures that are available, we listed a couple measures in our memo there, but I think one of them isn't even a U.S. measure. So we have quite a ways to go on this, but it's a very important component that needs to be taken into account if we're going to have a serious conversation about quality care delivery to duals. So the last two areas I'll kind of talk about together, because they're fairly unconventional if we're going to talk about measures. I'm not quite sure that this is something that would be a focus of NQF, but more at the state, local, regional, even organization level. But they did seem to come up quite frequently. This is utilization benchmarking and also process improvement across settings. For both of them, particularly utilization benchmarking, it's important if areas, states, regions are going to try to improve the quality of their care delivery, they also need to know how they're doing relative to the rest of the country. On our site visits, we had data with us on how some of these areas, when we went to them, were doing relative to the rest of the country, and most of them didn't, particularly in the low-performing areas, they didn't even know where they stood relative to the rest of the country. So that's a big thing. If people are going to take the time to try to improve the quality of their care delivery, they need to know where they stand and how far they have to go. And same with process improvement across settings, it's much more of a maybe organization-level measure, but it is important nonetheless if we're going to have all of these measures. We need to have a way to strive to improve upon them. So I think I will, that's pretty much as far as we got. We can talk a little bit more in depth about the specific measures. But I'm going to pass it off to Julia, who is going to talk about the obvious practical issues, particularly associated with the last couple of slides there.
Sure. So we obviously don't need to spend a lot of time on the practical issues. I thought Sarah this morning did a great overview of what the challenges are when you actually say you want to measure something to make sure that it's something that you can hold people accountable for, you identify the entities that are involved, that the data set is there, that the evidence is there, and that you have a large enough sample size from which to look at it. I mean, what I think is a real challenge for you all today is going to be to, as you identify these gaps, make sure that you focus on the priority areas and come up with the most important next steps to evolve where we want to get to. These practical issues are really critical in being able to move forward. And I think that part of the challenge here is that while we want to encourage people to be able to look at where they are, to benchmark and to meet certain quality criteria, we also want to develop measures that encourage process improvement and get us to where ultimately we would like different entities within the health system to be. So, and we're happy to open it up for questions at this point. We have a lot of much more detailed information we can share with any of you individually to the extent that you would be interested.
Yeah, the report was great. So, and thank you for being here in person to walk us through it. The measure set was really thorough and helpful. So, questions or comments, Rhonda?
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about utilization data. with this population, particularly when you're looking at ambulatory services, there's such a difference in the types of services that individuals would receive, even if they are the same subpopulation. So I was just trying to understand how you're going to approach that, because it can be different depending upon the community that they're in,
yes,
what services are available. So I'm
right, and all, yeah, no, I mean that's a big and very important thing to look at. What we were hearing, especially from the state administrators, was the concern that the who's being held accountable for which measures, and when you're looking at these subgroups, that we make sure that the information and the benchmarking is realistic given the population that you're talking about, even at the level of the frail elderly or the developmentally disabled or the or folks that are primarily having behavioral health issues or substance abuse issues, and what the expectations would be and what the benchmarking might be like for these different populations could be very, very different. You're right. But the I think there is, what we were hearing on the part of people on the ground was almost a fear of the idea that some of this is going to be measured at levels that has nothing to do with their individual experience with their population and their community and the supports that are or are not available in their individual community. And that's where the challenge really is.
I'm not sure. We heard very much, and certainly we haven't thought through in detail. I'm hearing from you, you know, how do you operationalize this, right? What's the unit of analysis, and how do you measure it? And I think the short answer is it's unclear. It was just an issue that we just heard repeatedly as important, and then making sure that's part of the discussion. But again, I think we've talked about this internally. It's one of those, we're squishy, and this is even squishier area too.
Well, we also heard, interestingly enough, that there are lots of different organizations that are currently developing their own measures for these same populations, mm-hmm, whether it be the PACE Association or the SNP Association or whomever, that are trying to come up with measures. And again, if you think about how they're doing them, they're each slightly different depending on what entity is accountable and the unique aspects of that population. So it's going to be a real challenge to pull all of that together across for a core set of measures for all of duals.
My last question had to do with your difficulty in getting substance use disorder data. We realize that there are special informed consents, but it kind of befuddles me because I think a lot of us have gone past that, unless we're doing illegal things and take that off the record, which I think we're not, but we use de-identified data, and
right,
I'm wondering if that's...
That came up repeatedly in the individuals and the groups of folks that we spoke with as a major, major problem. I mean, we have enough data problems in trying to just get Medicare and Medicaid data together.
Was it a perception of a of problems with HIPAA, or was it a reality?
Oh, we heard it was a reality, at least from state administrators, in terms of trying to get data, an absolute reality, that the limitations would not allow them to get information that was critical in terms of managing a patient's care.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a perception. And that's
it could be. I mean, we did not validate
that. What we heard.
What we hear is that the state administrators can match it up for themselves at a research level, but then to hand it off to the person who's actually doing the care management is so strictly controlled that, unless people give consent. I mean, a lot depends on your state laws, and some state laws are more strict than federal laws.
Well, it's hard to have any state law that's more strict than 42 CFR Part 2, but I would say that I also think that there is a perception that it's a problem to a greater extent than it actually is, especially when you're talking de-identified data. And there is a part of 42 CFR that allows release for research purposes without a client release. But I think it's, there's a lot of fears out there. I'm not disputing that you heard it all the time.
Right.
I'm disputing that it may actually be as big of a problem as they think it is.
Well, I think of the example in Asheville, North Carolina, where we met with the people from the Community Care Network, where mental health providers were in the same room with the physical health providers to do coordinated care, and there was always one mental health person at the clinics and always one clinic person at the mental health area, and they did a great job in terms of care management, mm-hmm. integrating dual diagnoses patients. So, you know, we could talk about the limitations, but there are also some ways to get around them that are very effective.
Okay, I don't see any cards up, and it is about time for our break. So thank you so much for being here, and thank you for giving us the written materials to use today.
11:20, and if you're late, you'll miss the instructions for how to use your dots, and you might put them in the wrong places. Okay. All right. Here are the instructions. Come back to the room so you can hear the instructions. Hi, Nicole. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Do we have any committee members on the phone? I'm just checking.
No.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Everyone has two sets of dots in front of you. Two sets of dots. You all have two sets of dots. You're not going to know what they represent unless you pay attention to the instructions. Here is exercise number one. We're going to do both rounds really quickly. Take your long description of measures in your hand and look through them before you get up. If there is a measure or measures in this long list that you like exactly the way it is written, with no changes to the specifications, no changes to the denominator at all, no changes to the numerator, if there are any measures that you love just as they are for the residuals population, then you take your bright colored dots, any one of these five or all five, however you want to prioritize them, come up to these flip charts and indicate with your dots your top five priority of measures that you like exactly the way they are. And we're going to take 10 minutes to do that. Look at your measures and apply your dots up here. All right? That's step one. After that part is done, we're going to peel the dots off and go back through and use the second set of dots to say, are there measures that you would like if you could modify them in some small way, like broaden the population, broaden the setting, etc.? So round one that you're doing right now is measures that you like just as is. All right? And you have until 11:30 for that, so take your time and look through the measure set. Yep. Yes. Yes. The long strip is probably a more neon-y color set, and you're using the more neon color first, right? But it doesn't matter so much. They'll come and peel them off before we do our next round. Don't panic. Not necessarily. If there is a measure on this table that you like the way it is written, whether it's endorsed or not endorsed. All right? And by the way, Adam is taking the prerogative of, if there's no measure that you like exactly the way it's written, you can stand up and have another 10 minutes of break time. So that is your other option. If there's no measure that's good as is.
Oh. Yeah, I shortened these two, or actually took them up a level to a topic. So, that's the CPM3. We
did talk a lot about selecting at the concept level yesterday, and that's the way we designed the flip charts for voting, and we're still going to do that. But because we've heard from Cheryl today that they're also interested in measures they can run with that are already specified, we added just now this other set of voting. Bonus round of voting. So
will that be clear enough, though?
I can quickly read off which one of these map to the measures in the list, if that's helpful.
We could just use the honesty practice and walk through just run through these levels really fast, and if there's any that you love, you'd get five times to raise your hand, and you could raise your hand. How about if we do that instead?
Show of hands.
All right, let's do that. All right, you're all limited to five, and we're going to use the honesty practice.
You still get 10 minutes to look at it.
Yeah.
Can I ask Tom if any are e-specified?
Yes.
Okay.
As a proxy for e-specifications, you can look in the data source column, and if there is EHR listed as a data source, that's an indication.